mainstream media of what has been happening in Gaza and around the world. And I believe that the change is coming in America. I really do. I mean, I look at the demonstrations and the encampments in the universities, all the universities, especially the Ivy League, and we see those are the potential leaders in America. And I believe that they, in the next maybe decade or two decades, things will change in America. But we have to be patient. We have to be persistent. We have to continue to tell the truth. Once the American people know what is happening, they will make the right decision. That's what happened in 1968. Actually, you know, the history repeats itself when they were demonstrating against the Vietnam War, and people prevailed, and they changed, you know, policy. And today, the same thing is happening. America is waking up. The American people are waking up to the fact that there is a crime being committed against civilians in Palestine, and there is a situation there that has been brewing for 76 years, and it is time to end. And therefore, they're going to be aware of it, and they will change it. It's going to take time. Change in America is coming. I believe in the new generation. I believe in what you guys are doing at Democracy Now! And others. And I think that this is changing opinion. And in fact, I see the change coming maybe in the next decade or two decades at most.
Osama Sablani, I want to thank you for being with us, founder and publisher of the Arab American News, largest, most widely circulated Arab American publication in the United States, speaking to us from Dearborn, Michigan. Harris's campaign manager, Julie Chavez Rodriguez, met with him for the second time last week. Coming up, we'll speak with two Chicago men who spent decades in prison before being exonerated. Stay with us.
All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put our two hearts together again. We sat on the wall of happiness. We sat on the wall of love. We sat on the wall of security, so high above.
King's Horses, Aretha Franklin, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we broadcast from here in Chicago at CAN TV.
Well, we look now at how the city has a long history of police torture under Police Commander John Burge, who is accused of leading a torture ring that interrogated more than 100 African-American men in Chicago in the 1970s and 1980s. They routinely used electric shock and suffocation with plastic bags and typewriter covers, among others, methods to extract confessions from men who were later shown to be innocent. This comes as Illinois has one of the highest rates of wrongful convictions in the United States, and a disproportionate number of the wrongly convicted are black or brown people.
For more, we're joined by two men from right here in Chicago who were exonerated after serving decades in prison. Stanley Howard spent 16 years of his life on death row for a 1984 murder that evidence would later show he did not commit. He says he was tortured until he confessed to the crime. He's the co-founder of the Death Row 10, a group of black men on Illinois' death row who were tortured by the notorious Chicago police commander John Burge and his detectives. Howard was pardoned by Governor George Ryan in 2003. He co-authored the book Tortured by Blue, the Chicago police torture story. We're also joined by Jimmy Soto, who was released from an Illinois prison just this past December 14th after a 42-year fight to prove his innocence. At the time of his release, Jimmy Soto was the longest-serving exonerated prisoner in Illinois history. Now he's working on getting a law degree to help others like him. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! It's an honor to have you with us. As you both actually just recently got out, I don't know if people remember what happened in the expose, and he even went to court and was convicted of perjury, lying about the cover-up of torture of black men in Chicago, John Burge. But you were one of those victims. If you can talk about what happened to you and what it meant to serve more than 40 years in prison, Stanley Howard.
Well, what happened to me was a crime. I was tortured on November the 1st, November the 2nd of 1984. When I mean by torture, I was handcuffed with my hands behind my back. And that set of cuffs was cuffed to a ring on the wall. And these three detectives literally beat the heck out of me. When I refused to sign a confession to a crime I did not commit, they suffocated me with a plastic bag and later a typewriter cover. I thought these three white detectives were actually trying to kill me. Mind you, I was 21 years old, scared half to death, and in fear of losing my life inside of this interview room at 3:34 o'clock in the morning. I actually agreed to sign the confession to a crime I did not commit. I later discovered, when evidence started coming out, that I was not the only one. And at that time, I was assured that justice was going to prevail. I did not know that all three branches of government was either complicit in the scandal or worked to cover it up or just simply turned a blind eye to what was going on. Maybe because they didn't care. As long as they was attaining convictions, that's all it was about. I ended up on death row. And the courts kept seeing cases after cases after cases of the same officers' names and the same techniques. But they kept denying all of the appeals. So I wanted to take the argument from behind the closed doors of death row. And I wanted to take it to the streets. I wanted the people, if the people was willing to hear our stories and allow the state of Illinois to execute us, so be it. So I started the Death Row 10, and that campaign, we reached out to the campaign to end the death penalty, and they helped us facilitate our public fight, if you will. And based on that, we started getting more movement, especially with Anthony Porter, who was released from death row after spending years and years on death row, and was 30-some hours away from being executed. This is the time that we started the Death Row 10, along with the time that Latanya Haggerty, a young girl that was killed by Chicago police because she had a cell phone in her hand.
And you actually, while the time you were in prison, you became a jailhouse lawyer helping so many other inmates. Can you talk about the experiences that you had there helping to mount the legal arguments and the basis for yourself and others eventually being freed?
Well, I had the experience of working with my appellate lawyer, who was horrible. So I started studying criminal law myself. I didn't get any formal education, but I trained, I studied, and I studied, and I studied. And I got to the point to where as I wanted to have a say in my life, my appeals. And I believe I got to the point to where as I wanted to help other guys on death row also. Which is why I started the law class, so-called law class. And based on the law class, we was able to get together, formulate arguments, organize and push our fight, not just for the death row tent, but to counter the claims of the death penalty here in Illinois. At one point, we had 12, 13 guys executed, but we had 12, 13 guys released from death row. So that tells you something is wrong. And through my advocacy, it wasn't just simply about me. I wanted to help the other guys that I was there with to help save their lives also, because I believe a government like this government should not be in the business of executing people under any circumstances.
You were on death row for how many years?
16 years.
16 years.
Locked inside of a cell 23, 24 hours a day, every day. Torture. So I was tortured by cops. Then I was tortured by the state of Illinois.
And now you are free. Former Republican Governor George Ryan, Governor of Illinois, commuted 167 prisoners on death row to life in prison. And then you have before that, after that, on 2011, Democratic Governor Pat Quinn signed legislation that made Illinois the 16th state to abolish the death penalty. Jimmy Soto, I want to turn to you. Congratulations on being out, but the horror that you were in for over 40 years, the longest held prisoner, exonerated prisoner in this country, tell us your story.
Well, you know, it happened in 1981 on the southwest side of Chicago in an area called Little Village. A tragic shooting occurred, and I gave it no thought that it would ever come on my doorstep. Unfortunately, the police, as Stanley was pointing out, in that time period, used tactics in which they wanted to just close a case. And so being pressured by those in authority in the city of Chicago, they set out to try to just solve the case in a way that skirted any legal methods that they should have done. They rounded up approximately 25 people from that area, 20 of which were under the age of 17. So just think of that. These are juveniles. Held them for 3 days and got them to make false statements on me. They took them to the grand jury, and they put the case on me. There was no evidence, physical, forensic, no eyewitnesses. They managed to get one individual to stand up and be what they say, quote unquote, an accomplice witness. And years of fighting, like Stanley, I was self-taught prison litigator. Over the course of that time, I managed to get two people fully exonerated, and I was able to get over 300 sentence reductions and 14 new trials. But, you know, the actual fight was to get me out, and eventually that happened. It wasn't easy. It wasn't an easy task, and I never want to see anybody go through that. Unfortunately, like as you indicated, Juan, at the beginning of the show, that Illinois has some of the highest numbers of exonerations. I went to an exoneration conference in Louisiana shortly after I was released, and by far Illinois, in just a year, 1 year, exceeded any other state for exonerations. And when I looked at the whole room and seeing those thousands of people that have been exonerated over the years, it's a clear red flag that there's something seriously wrong with our criminal justice system.
And also, Illinois is a state that does not have parole for folks who are in prison. Can you talk about that and the and what that does in terms of people staying in longer?
Yes. As I was sentenced to natural life without parole, which is a slow death by incarceration. And during that time in there, we started. I was going to school. I went to the Northwestern Prison Education Program, but I also joined PNAP, the Prison Neighborhood Arts Project. And there was a think tank. And in that think tank, individuals said, hey, there is no parole in Illinois. We need to do something about it. And right there was an effort birthed, which we wanted to have paroleillinois.org. And we formed a nonprofit organization to bring back parole. There's been no parole in Illinois since 1978. And there's a lot of people who have, quote unquote, been rehabilitated, yet they linger for decades in the most horrible conditions. Because it's not only the fact that I did 42 years, 2 months, 2 days, it's the conditions in which I did it. As Stanley indicated, it is really slow torture every day.
And you mentioned also the discussions we had yesterday that you also were organizing within the prison in terms of the Latino prisoners. You, for a while, you spent time with some of the FALN pro-independence folks that were in prison as well.
That's correct. You know, Luis Rosa in particular. As I said, there was programs giving you higher education, but they had nothing to show to give us an education about our history, Latinos. And so we decided to formulate the Latino Cultural Exchange Committee, which was an independent program, which we now start to bring in the history of Puerto Rico, Mexico, Central America, South America, and bringing it to those and to awaken within them some dignity and some pride in their heritage.
Can you talk about the case of 51-year-old Michael Broadway, who died just this past June in Stateville Prison, just the year before he was one of your classmates who were among the first group of incarcerated men to receive a bachelor's degree from a top 10 university, Northwestern?
Yeah. Well, Michael was not only a cohort, but a friend. And when I learned about his death in June, it really hit me hard because it shouldn't have happened. The conditions there were inhabitable. An independent engineering report that the IDOC was aware of said that six of the prisons in Illinois were not fit to have human beings in there. And so Michael was in one of those prisons, Stateville. He was on one of the highest galleries, and it was very warm. It was hot. It was over 100 degrees, no circulation, window seal shut. Michael had an asthma attack and unfortunately died. And when I learned that that happened, I held a town hall meeting here in Chicago, and there was another organization was born. A movement was birthed in that I said, I'm going to do something about this and bring awareness of what's going on. And I call it Building Communities, Not Prisons, to not let Michael's death be in vain. And so we pushed really hard to get Stateville closed. And I'm glad to say that finally a federal court judge ordered Stateville closed by September 30th. But it doesn't end there. The women in Logan are also subjected to horrible conditions, and we're pushing to get that closed and all of those prisons closed. The IDOC is operating at only 60%. That means they got 40% room, but yet they want to knock down Stateville and Logan and rebuild new prison at a cost of $900 million. And my question is, why can't we take that $900 million and put it at the front end to prevent people coming to prison as opposed to investing in the future that we're saying we're going to continue this nightmare of mass incarceration?
And when you talk about conditions, could you talk about what those conditions are? Even the water supply in many of these prisons is toxic?
Yes. It's been really noted that they know that these antiquated prisons, for one, the plumbing, the piping, it's got lead pipes, so that means the lead's going to be in water. But even the sources like the aquifers that are there in Will County, in Joliet, the sources where they get the water that is ran to the prison, is also has heavy metals, other toxins which is in the water, which is causing it. I personally had my blood tested, and I had elevated levels of lead caused by the drinking that water in Stateville.
So you've been invited to the Democratic National Convention Tuesday night?
Yes, by a group called FWD.US. And I'm going to go there and meet some people. And they are a group who wants to show that how immigration right now, which is a hot topic issue, and carceral systems are intertwined. You know, because now they want to criminalize. They want to criminalize black and brown bodies, and this is a way to further criminalize through saying these migrants that are coming in are, quote-unquote, bad hombres, bad people.
And Stanley, I wanted to ask you, Democratic National Convention is about to nominate a former prosecutor, Kamala Harris, as the Democratic candidate for president. Your sense of the continued emphasis, even among the Democrats, on punishment and incarceration as a means of dealing with crime?
Well, I'd like to also say that the mental health service inside of prison is terrible. The health care is terrible, and all the buildings are crazy. I did a protest out in front of Cook County jail a couple of weeks ago, and I looked at this building where the prosecutor's office was at. Mind you, if when you say that Cook County is the wrongful capital, wrongful conviction capital of the world, somebody had to be involved in that. It was the prosecutors. They all got away with it and still getting away with it. Kamala Harris, I do not know much about her history as a prosecutor, but knowing that there's a prosecutor at the helm of our government, and she's going to reach back and tell these prosecutors that their number one job is to seek justice and not convictions, I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. I have many questions for her about her life as a prosecutor, but I also would like to know what she's going to do to reform this system from the time when they used to call, quote unquote, the war on drugs, the war on crime, and just get tough on crime, to where, as we know, that crime has continued to fall, and all these dramatic rulings and bills that they put in place, what about rolling those back now? What is she going to do for that effort? And that's why I'm here now. Since I've been out, I'm working at Uptown People's Law Center, who does great work for those on the inside. And I received telephone calls from family members. I asked the guys on this side's mail also. And to know that prosecutors are at the helm of this mass incarceration. Jimmy said there was thousands of people that was wrongfully convicted at this conviction that he was at. Mm-hmm. Prosecutors prosecuted their cases. Mm-hmm. And I, like I said in my book, Tortured by Blue, the problem with prosecutors is that it takes a prosecutor to prosecute a prosecutor, but prosecutors are not in the business of prosecuting prosecutors.
Yeah. 24 states allow the death penalty. 23 states have abolished capital punishment altogether. 3 states, California, Oregon, and Pennsylvania, have governor-issued moratoriums in place, halting executions in the state. We're almost at the point where more than half of the states in this country will abolish the death penalty. And then the argument will be overall in terms of getting rid of it, that it is cruel and unusual punishment. The U.S. is very rare in the industrialized world in continuing with the death penalty. Your thoughts on this, Stanley, as a man who might have been executed if it weren't for your activism and your community that fought for you until ultimately you were exonerated.
Well, it's kind of ironic that the Conservative Party is for life on the front end, but they are for death on the back end. I do not understand that philosophy. But we have a guy by the name of Mary Hooper who was transferred from Illinois' death row to Arizona. It's amazing that half of Arizonans do not trust their government, so much so they don't even trust the election. But he was executed last year. So the government is in the business of executing people, but can't get their elections right. I believe that a country that executes its citizens really do not have the moral compass to tell another country nowhere around this planet what to do. It was once said that if you want to know what is going on in the country, all you have to do is look inside the prisons and look inside the death row. And we have to end this death penalty in this country. And we have to end life without the possibility of parole also.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. It has been so important. Do you think, when it comes to the Democratic and Republican leaders of this country, that it makes a difference who is in power?
Absolutely.
I'll end with you, Jimmy.
Absolutely it does. I mean, we have to get a Democrat in there. Kamala may not be the best candidate, but we need to get out there and vote, because the only other alternative is Trump. And I think Trump will turn this country upside down to where we're going to probably go back 10, 15 years of progress that we made, because not only economically, but even within our carceral system. There needs to be a change. It needs to be a change now.
Well, I want to thank you both again. Jimmy Soto, longest-serving exonerated prisoner in Illinois history. Since his release in December, he's been working on going to law school, getting a law degree to help others like him. And Stanley Howard, co-founder of Death Row 10, spent 16 years of his life on death row for a 1984 murder that evidence would later show he did not commit.
And in breaking news, the pioneering TV host Phil Donahue has died at the age of 88. The Phil Donahue Show, later renamed Donahue, ran from the 1960s through to 1996 and tackled major social and political issues, including women's rights, child abuse in the Catholic Church, prisons, and racism. Among his notable interview subjects was Nelson Mandela, whom he spoke with shortly after his release from a South African prison in 1990. Over his career, Donahue won 20 Emmy Awards and received a Peabody Award.
In 2003, Phil Donahue was fired from his primetime MSNBC talk show during the run-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It was the most popular talk show on MSNBC at the time. The problem wasn't Phil's ratings, but rather his views. An internal MSNBC memo warned Donahue was a, quote, difficult public face for NBC in a time of war, providing a, quote, home for the liberal anti-war agenda at the same time that our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity, unquote. In 2013, we spoke to Phil Donahue about his firing.
I think what happened to me, the biggest lesson, I think, is the how corporate media shapes our opinions and our coverage. This was the decision to release me, came from far above. This was not an assistant program director who decided to separate me from MSNBC. They were terrified of the anti-war voice, and that is not an overstatement. Anti-war voices were not popular. And if you're General Electric, you certainly don't want an anti-war voice on a cable channel that you own. Donald Rumsfeld's your biggest customer. So, by the way, I had to have two conservatives on for every liberal. I could have Richard Pearl on alone, but I couldn't have Dennis Kucinich on alone. I was considered two liberals. It really is funny almost when you look back on how the management was just frozen by the anti-war voice. We were scolds. We weren't patriotic. American people disagreed with us. We weren't good for business.
That was the groundbreaking TV host and journalist Phil Donahue. Following his firing, Phil went on to co-direct the documentary Body of War that told the story of the U.S. Iraq War veteran Thomas Young, who was paralyzed after being shot in Iraq and came home to become an anti-war activist. Phil Donahue died on Sunday at the age of 88. He's survived by his wife, Marlo Thomas, his four children, and his grandchildren. Our condolences to the whole Thomas Donahue family. Phil Donahue, the pioneering TV talk show host. That does it for our show. We just have less than a minute to go. Tune in to our expanded daily two-hour broadcast from Chicago, from the Democratic National Convention, inside and out, from the streets to the suites to the convention floor. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable group of people: Mike Burke, Shrutha Gokhadoos, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresa, Sana, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Anna Elias. Our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, and right here to CAN TV. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're in Chicago. Scream!
That's the way I've always sung. This is my song.
Are there subliminal duets?
Absolutely not.
The Metal Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.